Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents To Catch a Spy, The Art of Counterintelligence by James M. Olson. Narrated by John McLean. Introduction. Treachery. Seek it out. William Shakespeare, Hamlet. Few Americans realize the extent to which foreign intelligence services are stealing our most important secrets, right here at home, right under our noses. America is hemorrhaging its vital secrets and sensitive technology, and we are not doing nearly enough to stop it. How many more traitors, like Clyde Lee Conrad, Jonathan Pollard, Chi Mack, Edward Lee Howard, and Ana Montez do we need before we begin to take betrayal from within more seriously? How can we sit idly by and watch the U.S. Office of Personnel Management database be breached, almost certainly by China, and not do more to hold those responsible accountable and to prevent future attacks? Counterintelligence, CI, consists of all the measures a nation takes to protect its citizens, secrets, and technology from foreign spies. It is axiomatic in CI that there are friendly countries, but there are no friendly intelligence services. With only a handful of exceptions, everyone spies on everyone else, friends and foes alike. Over 80 foreign countries that we know of either have successfully spied against the United States or have attempted to spy against us. That list, of course, includes countries that are at least nominally considered our friends. Even our good friends, the Israelis, risked our special relationship by running the American spy Jonathan Pollard against us in 1984 and 1985. We Americans, however, should not express our outrage too vehemently or try to take the high moral ground because the Israeli military intelligence officer Yossi Amit was convicted of spying against Israel on behalf of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, in 1987. The fact that everybody does it should not make it acceptable, since our concern is the harm being done to us. We are losing the espionage wars, and it is time for us to tighten our counterintelligence. The three most aggressive and damaging culprits currently undermining U.S. national security are China, Russia, and Cuba. I will be singling them out for separate discussion and analysis in later chapters. What these three countries are doing in terms of espionage and covert action inside the United States is outrageous and must be stopped. At no time in my career have I considered the challenges for U.S. counterintelligence greater than they are right now. I wish I could personally re-enter the battle, but short of that, I derive great satisfaction in teaching courses on intelligence and counterintelligence at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University to the next generation of intelligence professionals. Nothing brightens my day more than to hear back from former students about the exciting and important work they are doing in keeping our country safer. Perhaps the best example of that was when one of my former students, now a Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, special agent doing foreign counterintelligence work, sent me this message. "Professor Olson, I thought you might be interested in knowing that I was the lead FBI investigator for the Kendall and Gwendolyn Myers case. And there's more, Mr. Olson. I personally put the cuffs on them." Way to go. Several years ago, I wrote an article for the CIA's professional journal, Studies in Intelligence, titled "The 10 Commandments of Counterintelligence." I consider these guidelines for counterintelligence professionals as valid today as when I wrote them, but in light of subsequent events, I believe they need expansion. I propose to re-examine each of these 10 commandments and to add some corollaries that have surfaced in several recent counterintelligence cases. My hope is that this review of counterintelligence principles and methodologies will be of value not only to professionals in the field, but also to any U.S. government official or classified contractor responsible for safeguarding our country's sensitive secrets and technology. Finally, I believe that a better informed and alert public can play a valuable role in spotting anomalous behaviors that have counterintelligence implications and in notifying the appropriate authorities. A certain amount of theory and doctrine is good, but the crux of counterintelligence is in the specifics. It may be a byproduct of my legal education that I have become a strong proponent of the case study method of teaching. In my intelligence classes, I rely heavily on actual espionage cases to teach the principles, tradecraft, and ethics of intelligence. I have found this to be a particularly effective technique in teaching counterintelligence. In my book, Fair Play, The Moral Dilemmas of Spying, I used 50 morally questionable scenarios from the world of spying to highlight the murky ethical landscape of modern intelligence operations. I will do something similar here. By examining the specifics of several different spy cases, I believe that one can appreciate better the complexities and nuances of contemporary spy catching. It is not an easy task because counterintelligence is extremely hard to do. I sometimes refer to it in my classes as playing eight-dimensional chess against the best minds of other countries' intelligence services. James Jesus Angleton, the legendary chief of counterintelligence at the CIA from 1954 to 1974, described counterintelligence as a wilderness of mirrors that produces an ever-fluid landscape where fact and illusion merge. He was right. Counterintelligence can be an excruciatingly frustrating profession. You lose when you win. You feel good about uncovering spies in our midst, but you are then inevitably hit with the cutting follow-up questions. How could you let that happen? Wasn't it your job to prevent things like that? What took you so long? It is perfectly understandable to me that when Robert Hansen, the arrogant FBI spy for the Russians, was arrested by the FBI on February 18, 2001, he chose to deliver to his arresting team what he thought would be the ultimate CI insult. What took you so long? So, why do we do it? First, counterintelligence is the most demanding of all the intelligence disciplines, and many of our brightest men and women in national security careers welcome such a challenge. Counterintelligence never fails to stimulate the mind. It appeals to people who love solving puzzles, unraveling knots, and navigating labyrinths. There is also an inherent beauty in dedicating one's life to catching American spies and traitors and to foiling the machinations of our devious adversaries. I had the honor of spending much of my CIA career as a spy catcher and can state categorically that nothing in intelligence work compares to the ecstasy one feels in breaking a big CI case. That brings me to a not inconsequential benefit of being a counterintelligence professional. You join a very special club. I worked with many fine people in my lengthy intelligence career, and I have tremendous respect and admiration for them. But CI professionals are a breed apart. We feel a natural affinity for one another. We know how frustrating and thankless our chosen profession is, and how dangerous a steady diet of conspiracy and doublethink can be to our mental health. Still, we buckle up and march on. We get the job done. My best friends in the intelligence community were my CI colleagues. It made no difference to me if they were CIA, FBI, military, or any of the other constituent members of the Director of National Intelligence, DNI, community. We are the same people. We are brothers and sisters. I salute the fine men and women who are in CI careers now, and I encourage those of you out there now who aspire to join us one day to follow your dream. As a practitioner and teacher of intelligence, I have had the luxury of studying and reflecting on what constitutes good counterintelligence. I believe we can do it a lot better than we are now. We need reinforcements. Come join us. This book, for what it is worth, is my modest effort to contribute to the dialogue by offering my thoughts and recommendations on how to improve the art of counterintelligence. I do not pretend to have a monopoly on CI wisdom, but I hope my many years in the business will translate into some useful observations. 1. China. We have not yet begun to consider Red China espionage as a serious menace to our security in the U.S., though in the years to come it may well become a formidable instrument for spying and subversion. Alan Dulles, The Craft of Intelligence, 1965. If I were to start my CIA career all over again, I would try to get into our China program, learn Mandarin, and become a Chinese counterintelligence specialist. China is without question the number one counterintelligence threat facing the United States. I do not know a single counterintelligence expert anywhere who will say anything different. The Chinese are mounting a massive espionage, cyber, and covert action assault on the United States. Their goal is to catch up with the United States technologically, militarily, and economically as quickly as possible. If the American people fully understood the audacity and effectiveness of this campaign, they would be outraged and would demand action. Our top priority in U.S. counterintelligence today and into the future must be to stop or to drastically curtail China's spying. The Chinese have always been adept at espionage. In the early years of Chinese communism, the Russians provided intelligence training and material support to their struggling comrades. The Sino-Soviet split put an end to this cooperation, so beginning in the 1960s, Chinese intelligence has been on its own. By the 1970s, China had emerged as a world-class intelligence power and had decided that spying, especially commercial and industrial spying, was the fastest and cheapest way to build economic and military strength. The vast Chinese intelligence apparatus was restructured in 2015 and 2016. The principal Chinese External Intelligence Service is the Ministry of State Security, MSS, which is responsible for overseas espionage operations. The Ministry of Public Security, MPS, concentrates on domestic activities, but also occasionally runs agents abroad. The MSS and MPS were relatively unaffected by the recent organizational changes in the Chinese intelligence community. The major impact has been on the People's Liberation Army, PLA, which, since the 1950s, has been heavily engaged in intelligence operations. While in theory the PLA has concentrated on military intelligence, it has defined its role broadly and has competed with the MSS in a wide range of economic, political, and technological intelligence collection operations overseas, in addition to its more traditional military targeting. The PLA has been responsible for the bulk of China's cyber spying, but there are indications that the MSS has been assigned an expanded role in this area as well. Oversight of the PLA's technical intelligence capabilities, including cyber, signals, and imagery intelligence, resides with the new Strategic Support Force under the Central Military Commission. The PLA's human intelligence, HUMINT, operations are managed by the new Joint Staff Department, which likewise comes under the Central Military Commission. The previous breakdown of the PLA into intelligence departments, familiar to a whole generation of American intelligence officers, has been eliminated. There is no longer a 2PLA responsible for human intelligence, a 3PLA responsible for cyber operations and signals intelligence, or a 4PLA responsible for electronic warfare. These functions remain, but have been rolled into the new structure. The MSS and PLA make regular use of diplomatic, commercial, journalistic, and student covers for their operations in the United States. They aggressively use Chinese travelers to the U.S., especially business representatives, academics, scientists, students, and tourists, to supplement their intelligence collection. U.S. intelligence experts have been amazed at how voracious the Chinese have been in their collection activity. They take a vacuum cleaner approach and scoop up literally any kind of data they can get their hands on. The question of Chinese students in the U.S. is especially pertinent. According to Statista, in 2016 and 17, there were 350,755 Chinese nationals studying at U.S. colleges and universities, accounting for approximately one-third of the total of international students in our country. A large majority of these Chinese students are studying science or engineering, fields that have direct relevance to China's industrial and military aspirations. Many Chinese students are encouraged by Chinese intelligence to remain in the U.S., to obtain employment, and to acquire lawful permanent resident status. Lawful permanent residents can apply for U.S. citizenship after 5 years of residence, 3 years if they are married to a U.S. citizen. Naturalized U.S. citizens are eligible for U.S. government security clearances after 5 years of citizenship. This length of time is a trade-off between our need for certain skills, particularly technical skills, and security. Any intelligence service worthy of the name would jump at the chance to infiltrate its officers or co-optees into the government agencies, national laboratories, and high-technology firms of a priority target country. We have no numbers, of course, but it is inconceivable to me that the MSS and PLA would have overlooked this enticing and easily exploitable path to access. The enormity of the Chinese espionage effort is staggering, and it is getting worse. The FBI announced in 2015 that it had seen a 53% increase in economic espionage against U.S. companies over the previous year, most of it from China. The FBI does a fine job of briefing U.S. high-technology firms on the nature of the threat, but it admits that Chinese spying is so pervasive and relentless that U.S. companies remain extremely vulnerable. The MSS and PLA primarily play the ethnic card in their recruitment operations. They target the large numbers of ethnic Chinese, the so-called overseas Chinese, who live in the United States and virtually every other country in the world. The number of ethnic Chinese in the United States is approximately 4 million, and many of them are only a generation or less from the mainland. Large numbers of them still have relatives in communist China, and lots of them, quite understandably, feel pride and sympathy for the culture and accomplishments of China, particularly the great achievements and build-up of economic and military strength under Mao and his successors. The common tactic is to play on loyalty to Mother China and to exert pressure via relatives still living in China. A Chinese-American working in the U.S. government or in a high-tech firm would usually be approached on that basis. Not to be discounted, however, is that venality and greed can also play a large role in any recruitment of a spy. All Americans who visit China, but particularly Chinese-Americans, are assessed as potential recruitment targets, and those who have access and show susceptibility are singled out for aggressive development. Does it work? You bet it does. We can assume that many of these approaches are rebuffed, but here is just a quick partial listing of Chinese Americans who have fallen into this trap. Lieutenant Commander Edward C. Lin, U.S. Navy, a signals intelligence specialist on the Navy's Lockheed Martin P-3E reconnaissance aircraft, was accused of giving classified U.S. military information to China. He was sentenced to 6 years in prison. Xu-Sing Ho, a nuclear engineer at the Tennessee Valley Authority, was accused of recruiting at least six other American engineers to pass sensitive U.S. nuclear technology to China. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison and fined $20,000. Peter Lee, a physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory and TRW, was accused of passing microwave submarine detection technology and other classified defense information to China. He was sentenced to 1 year in a halfway house. Chi Mack, an engineer working for Power Paragon in California, was accused of passing to China highly classified information on U.S. Navy surface ships and submarines. He was sentenced to 24 years in prison. Fei Yi, a Silicon Valley engineer, was accused of stealing computer microprocessor technology on behalf of China. He was sentenced to 1 year in prison. Walter Lin Hin Lu, owner and president of USA Performance Technology Incorporated of Oakland, California, was accused of passing chloride route titanium dioxide production technology to China. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Greg Chung, an engineer at Boeing, was accused of passing proprietary information on the U.S. space program to China. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Katrina Leung was a different kind of spy. Her objective was not to steal U.S. technology, but to infiltrate U.S. counterintelligence, and she succeeded brilliantly. Leung was born in China in 1954. She emigrated to the U.S. as a teenager in 1970 and graduated from a New York City high school in 1972. Obviously very bright, she graduated from Cornell University in 1976 and then earned an MBA degree from the University of Chicago. In 1980, Leung and her husband moved to Los Angeles, where they found success working at an export-import company and a business consulting firm. They had a lavish lifestyle and cultivated influential friends in California business and politics. Leung was active in the local Chinese-American community and bragged that she had excellent contacts in China, including prominent political leaders. In fact, when high-ranking Chinese visitors came to California, Leung often served as their guide, interpreter, and host. Leung's activities did not escape the FBI's attention, and in 1982 she was recruited by the Bureau to report on Chinese government officials. Her recruiter and handler was FBI Special Agent James J. Smith, who was Leung's case agent for 18 years until his retirement from the FBI in 2000. At FBI direction, Leung traveled frequently to China to ingratiate herself with her current contacts and to seek new ones. The FBI was delighted to learn that some of Leung's contacts were MSS officers. In a short time, Leung, codenamed Parlor Maid, became one of the best informants on Chinese intelligence personnel and activities that the FBI had. Smith urged Leung to dangle herself to the MSS in the hope that she could become a double agent, DA. The ploy worked, and Leung was recruited by the MSS in 1984. The same year, she became a U.S. citizen. Leung was a productive source for the FBI for 20 years. Her reporting went to the highest levels of the U.S. government. Smith's trust of her was so complete that he overlooked strong indicators as early as 1991 that she was not being truthful, and moreover, had unauthorized and unreported contacts with MSS officers. Smith shared classified information with Leung to assist her in her DA role. The FBI paid Leung $1.7 million in salary and expenses. When Smith retired in 2000, he was awarded the Intelligence Medal of Achievement for his work with Parlor Maid. One reason that Smith was so protective of Leung and deflected all CI suspicion of her was that he had been having an affair with her since the early 1980s. Not only that, but Leung was also sleeping with another FBI counterintelligence special agent, William Cleveland, who worked out of the FBI's San Francisco office. Smith was so careless that he carried top-secret documents in his briefcase when he had trysts with Leung at her Los Angeles home, giving her the opportunity to copy the documents when he was asleep or in another room. Leung had been working for the MSS all along. The duplicity began to unravel in 2000. The FBI put Leung under surveillance and made a surreptitious search of her home. There, agents found a stash of FBI documents. Leung and Smith were arrested in 2003. The FBI did not welcome parading its dirty laundry in public or revealing sensitive sources and methods. Furthermore, the elements of espionage are extremely difficult to prove in court. So, the case was settled with plea agreements. Smith pleaded guilty in 2004 to a reduced charge of lying to the FBI about his affair with Leung and was fined $10,000. Leung pleaded guilty in 2005 to filing fraudulent tax returns and lying to the FBI. She was sentenced to 3 years probation, 100 hours of community service, and a $10,000 fine. Cleveland was never charged, and after he left the FBI, he became chief of security at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. This list is certainly incomplete and does not include Chinese citizens who have permanent resident alien status in the United States or who travel frequently to the U.S. on business. Not listed as well are some U.S. citizens who are not Chinese Americans who have been caught spying for China. Although they are relatively few in number because of the strong Chinese propensity to recruit Chinese Americans, some of them have done serious damage. One recent example is the hapless Benjamin Bishop, a former U.S. Army lieutenant colonel working at U.S. Pacific Command in Hawaii, who was sentenced in 2014 to 7 years in prison for passing classified defense information to his Chinese girlfriend. The 27-year-old woman entered a romantic relationship with the then 59-year-old Bishop while she was a graduate student in the U.S. on a J-1 exchange visitor visa. On March 28, 2017, Candace Claiborne, a 60-year-old U.S. State Department administrative officer, was arrested by the FBI and charged with obstructing an official proceeding and lying to the Bureau about her contacts with Chinese intelligence officials. Claiborne is alleged to have had unauthorized dealings with the Chinese from 2011 to 2016 and to have received benefits for herself and relatives amounting to tens of thousands of dollars. There is no indication that ethnicity was a factor. Claiborne began working for the State Department in 1999 and had a top-secret clearance. She had several overseas assignments, including in Shanghai and Beijing. It has not yet been made public what Claiborne passed to the Chinese, how and where she was recruited, or how she was handled. It is known, however, that her cooperation with Chinese intelligence continued after her departure from Beijing in 2012 and her reassignment to State Department headquarters in Washington, D.C. Another example of a non-ethnic recruitment of Americans by the Chinese is Glenn Duffy Shriver. Shriver was a 19-year-old college student from Michigan studying Chinese language and international relations. He went to China for a summer study program in 2001. He was so taken with Chinese language and culture that he went back to China in 2002 for a junior year abroad. After his graduation from Grand Valley State University in 2004, he returned to China to perfect his Mandarin and to immerse himself in all things Chinese. He soon fell prey to a classic intelligence spotting mechanism. He answered an ad seeking a volunteer to write an article on U.S.-China relations. He wrote the article, was of course praised by the article's sponsor, and received a fee of $120. The MSS now had a hot prospect and was off and running. Shriver soon realized that he was in contact with Chinese intelligence officers, but that did not faze him. He accepted a payment of $10,000 from the MSS to take the U.S. Foreign Service exam, which he did in 2005. He did not pass. For another payment of $20,000, Shriver retook the exam in 2006, but again failed. Next, he was instructed by his MSS handler to return to the United States to apply to the CIA's clandestine service, which he did in 2007. As a now fluent Mandarin speaker, Shriver was an attractive candidate for the CIA. His processing was suspended, however, when he returned to China to meet with his MSS handler and then continued to South Korea to teach English. During Shriver's China stopover, he was paid $40,000 by the MSS to encourage him to press forward with his CIA application. the MSS thought it was closing in on an eagerly sought penetration of the CIA's clandestine service. Shriver traveled to Washington, D.C. in May 2010 for what he believed was his final processing. In reality,
sample complete. Ready to continue?